Chapter 17. The Name Game and the Immaculate Recombination. How many have we created, John? How many XMRVs are out there? Judy Mikovits. There's an old joke about a man who goes over to his neighbor's house to borrow a lawnmower. "I'm sorry," the neighbor replies as he stands in his driveway near the mouth of his open garage, "but I lent it to my cousin who lives on the other side of town." But the man sees the lawnmower in plain sight, just on the other side of his neighbor's bike propped on a garage wall. "But it's right there," argues the man. "What does the reason matter?" asks the neighbor. "I'm never going to give it to you anyway." In her research on XMRV, Mikovits would often feel like the man in the old joke asking to borrow his neighbor's lawnmower. The reason for her lack of support never seemed to matter. No one in authority would consider the notion that a retrovirus was associated with ME/CFS, regardless of the evidence she and others presented. She suspected the scientific hierarchy had already made the decision that retroviruses were not involved in ME/CFS, and they would not bend. Mikovits remembered all too well the stories of Frank Rossetti from the 1970s, when he was working as a postdoc in the Gallo lab. Coffin and most of the other famous scientists in the field emphatically told him not to bother because there were no such things as human retroviruses. Rossetti and Bernie Poise were presenting their research at the 1980 Cold Springs Harbor Conference that indeed they'd isolated HTLV-1, an infectious human retrovirus from patients with adult T-cell leukemia, ATL. It was so heretical that Gallo, who always attended the CSH meeting in those days and had promised to come, never showed up, leaving Bernie and Frank to face any dissonant music themselves. David Baltimore and Howard Temin, who both received the Nobel Prize for the discovery of reverse transcriptase, and other giants of the field usually sat in the front row. Coffin had worked in the Temin lab as a postdoc and published with him in 1971. More than half a century had been spent trying to unlock the secrets of the first known animal retrovirus. Rossetti and Poise's presentation of their isolation of the first human retrovirus had been slated for the Sunday morning of the 1980 CSH gathering. At that time, any session about human retroviruses was always held on Sunday morning, after all the important people had already left, and very few of the influential leaders of the field stuck around. The majority of the remaining audience greeted their findings with silence, while the anti-human retrovirus critics simply walked out. It reminded Rossetti of the tense walkout for Robert Koch when he gave a lengthy dissertation of his discovery on the TB-causing bacteria. All the great German scientists like Rudolf Virchow, who had been critics, just exited without a word. After the discovery of HTLV-1, Coffin hadn't been much of a factor in Rossetti's life for the last 3.5 decades, except when they crisscrossed at conferences. Mikovits really didn't have much of an opinion about Coffin until he showed up as one of the organizers of the hastily called July 22, 2009 meeting at the NIH, prior to the publication of the Science article. Perhaps Coffin was briefly worried that he hadn't pursued relevant data on other retroviral sequences witnessed 30 years ago. Maybe that was when he decided to write the accompanying editorial in Science, entitled A New Virus for Old Diseases. Brigitte Huber, who had a laboratory near Coffin at Tufts, first suggested that XMRV was mere mouse contamination at the XMRV workshop at the Cleveland Clinic in November of 2009. She said that in some very preliminary testing, she had not been able to find evidence of the XMRV retrovirus sequence as defined by Silverman and DeRisi. Her explanation for the failure was that the labs involved, the Cleveland Clinic, the National Cancer Institute, and the Whittemore Peterson Institute, must have inadvertently had small pieces of mouse droppings, blood, or hair that had somehow found their way into the testing materials. Rossetti thought that Huber was a stalking horse for Coffin. Mikovits and Rossetti wittily dubbed it the mousecrap theory of XMRV. The situation had started to spiral out of control, and somebody needed to put a stop to it. The Cold Springs Harbor Retrovirology Conference of May 2010 was something of a counterstrike when Alter and Lowe reported the confirmation of the science paper, as well as their unpublished findings of a larger family of mouse, murine, leukemia viruses present in these patients. Moreover, publication of their confirmation study had been cagily delayed, while the negative study by the CDC by Switzer zipped through to publication like it was on a jet stream, the eventual publication of the Lowe and Alter paper in August of 2010 finally seemed to debunk and mark the death knell of the mousecrap theory, turning it back to compost. Francis Collins's decision that the data presented at the first international conference on XMRV now required a multi-center study to reconcile the positive and negative studies under the direction of Lipkin, further undercut the mousecrap theory of Coffin and his cronies. Coffin attended the November 4, 2010 meeting with Lipkin to set up the multicenter study. He sat on the other side of the conference table from Mikovits, disengaged from her, although the end of the meeting presented an awkward comedic opportunity. Right then, Harvey Alter asked if anybody wanted to share a ride to the airport. Mikovits and Coffin said yes, so they all squeezed into the back of a cab. Because she was smaller than them, Mikovits was flanked in the back seat by Coffin on her left and Alter on her right. Alter was friendly, asking how a cancer and AIDS researcher had become involved in ME/CFS. She told him the story, and he listened with complete attention. By contrast, Coffin on her left huddled up against the left window, ignoring their presence. Coffin's impending publications would support the mouse contamination theory. Despite the Lowe and Alter findings, the drumbeat of contamination accusations continued, bolstered by the journal Retrovirology, edited by Quanti Zhang, which published 5 articles on December 22, 2010, reporting the presence of mouse DNA into human materials and PCR reagent kits, as well as presence of MLV sequences in some widely used reagents. Others reported that sequences giving rise to clones of Silverman XMRV were identical to those in the prostate cell line 22RV1. As a reviewer of one of the 5 papers that he thought needed more work to warrant publication, Rossetti was annoyed when it was published anyway, but Zhang told him that together the 5 papers supported one another, thus they surely didn't need the same level of vetting the Mikovits paper had gone through with Science. Shortly after those papers came out in the winter of 2010 to 2011, Rossetti was unexpectedly called into a meeting in his supervisor's office, the head of Center for Cancer Research, CCR, with Coffin and 6 of his colleagues. At that time, Coffin and Dr. Vinay Patak presented their evidence that Silverman's XMRV was actually a laboratory-generated virus as a result of a recombination between what they called pre-XMRV1 and pre-XMRV2. This recombination had such a low chance of occurring that XMRV in any specimens that contained evidence of XMRV must have been contaminated through routine lab procedures like tissue culture, and concluded there was no evidence that people or any animal species were naturally infected by XMRV. This meant, to them, that all the positive data had either to be a result of contamination with mouse products or a laboratory-made viral artifact generated by recombination. Coffin told Frank Rossetti that science started this and science will end it. Rossetti thought to himself then, what had science started? Their paper had gone through standard review process and then a few other hoops, and had not been Coffin part of starting it as author of the news and views accompanying the paper? As far as Rossetti was concerned, if recombination theory was true, it was the first time a retrovirus infecting human cells and had no natural history of infecting people was created in the lab. Who could have known beforehand? Nobody would have then started it. It would have been a self-generating accident resulting in exotic biology for which no scientist is responsible for knowing. The State of the Knowledge Conference in April of 2011 was the next opportunity for Mikovits and Coffin to spend considerable time together, and the patient and scientific communities seemed to have chosen their champion. Mikovits felt there was no room for personality squabbles and preferred to focus on healthy scientific debate. If somebody could come up with a good argument backed up with data that didn't completely rewrite the rules of retrovirology, she was ready to listen to any refutation. But as the mouse crap theory of contamination continued to crumble, assisted by a German study that found that about 10% of immune-compromised patients in that country had XMRV sequences in nasal swabs, the argument of doubters again started to swing toward the XMRV recombination theory. In addition to the mouse crap theory, doubters who took the tack of that joke's projecting husband came up with a second theory, which could best be described as, "Holy mouse crap, we created a new retrovirus." The theory was that XMRV was a lab-created retrovirus, a recombinant virus, the type of deformed sci-fi monster that would strike mortal panic into the general public, but added caveats. We don't know if this recombinant retrovirus has ever infected people. If it has infected people, we think the normal human immune system would keep it from being a problem, remain calm. The guardians of public health will get to the bottom of all this. From the beginning of their investigation, the Mikovits-Rossetti labs had never been able to find Silverman's XMRV. The only evidence of that sequence in the paper was done in Silverman lab. It was only when she'd told her research associate Max Post to relax the PCR conditions did they detect sequences related to XMRV Silverman. They had, in other words, been looking in the general library, but needed to open the secret door behind a bookcase to get to the hidden editions. At one point during their face-off at the State of the Knowledge workshop in April of 2011, Coffin made a statement that puzzled Mikovits even years later. As she went over the various pieces of information supporting an XMRV infection, including the electron micrographs, the immune response from multiple proteins, and strain differences when sequencing larger parts of the envelope of the virus, Coffin said in a very heated voice, "I'm not saying it isn't another retrovirus. I'm just saying it's not that retrovirus." Was this all just some kind of name game? What did it matter to the millions who suffered from chronic ME/CFS, the millions with prostate cancer, and possibly the millions of children with autism and other neurological problems if there were variations in the retroviral sequences? Virus strains could have variations in the genetic sequences. From the beginning, they'd been suspicious, as the full-length sequence of XMRV in patients was only done in Silverman's lab. Derisi and Silverman hadn't named the virus based on the classification of the sequence. They called it xenotropic because it wasn't found in a mouse, meaning it had leapt species. It had been found in human prostate tissue. Nobody knew then that the sequences were not actually in the tissue, but in the RNA made, cloned, from the tissue. It was a murine leukemia-related virus because it looked like a mouse retrovirus. DeRisi had laid it all out during his TED Talk in 2006 when he talked about his virochip technology. Mikovits couldn't help but wonder if all of the shifty semantics with Silverman and DeRisi were an attempt to control intellectual property that could be worth substantial fame and money after a giant discovery. Was Coffin interested in undiscovering XMRV so he could later rediscover it? At one point during the roundtable discussion, while Coffin was talking about contamination, Mikovits had finally had enough. She said, "These people aren't contaminated, they're infected. They make antibodies. An immune response is not a contaminant. I don't really care if you call it contamination or infection, but these people need a treatment." Antibodies are not cell phones picking up signals from tissues in a faraway lab. Why wasn't anyone listening to her explanation about the antibodies? Suffering patients needed help. Mikovits and Coffin both presented their points with searing passion. In the old boys network, Mikovits had to go by different rules. A woman could not be too fiery, and passion for patients was immediately viewed as overly soft toward the phobic, hysterical, maladaptive patients in her case, and unscientific. When it came time to do a wrap-up, Harvey Alter was troubled. He took Mikovits into a back room and said, "Judy, what do I do? He's so vehement that this is a recombination or contamination or something. What do you make of all this?" In the time she'd come to know Harvey Alter, she found him to be a decent, mild-mannered man who lived for the integrity of the scientific process. Like Alter, she was convinced there had been no evidence of contamination in a single experiment. She had been fully transparent with all data since day one. Mikovits and Rossetti did not cherry-pick the data. Mikovits had insisted on leaving conflicting data in Figure 1 even when Silverman wanted it removed. Rossetti stood by Mikovits. They had done all of the proper controls. The confounding data, which showed one sample 1118 negative for GAG or ENV sequences, but positive in another test for ENV and GAG proteins, remained in Figure 1. She walked through the science again. If it was contamination, how could you explain the antibody response? What about the sequence variation and the proteins detected by a monoclonal antibody that recognized all family members ever tested? They'd been able to take two slightly different viruses out of the same person, separated by a period of years, thus indicating it was not a one-time lab event. The proteins of the virus had come straight from unmanipulated tissue, and the electron micrographs of the virus budding from the cells were difficult to dismiss. How could that have been contamination? Eventually, Alter sighed and said, "Well, I've got the unpleasant task of summing this up." She shrugged. As the sports expression went, she'd left it all on the field. Alter had the ball now. Alter gave an excellent summation of the two competing theories. Mikovits knew Alter had been momentarily troubled, but his anxiety had melted into pure grace. He was well-informed, funny, and humble in the way a scientist should be in the face of things he does not fully understand. Alter began, "When two women claimed to be the mother of the same child, King Solomon made a judgment to cut the baby in half and resolve the dilemma, and it was resolved when the real mother gave up her share to save the baby's life." Well, I'm no Solomon, but I'm stuck here between the diametrically opposed viewpoints of Judy Mikovits and John Coffin, both of whose science I greatly respect, and I don't truthfully know who to cut or what to cut, except that I'd like to cut out of here. The audience laughed at Alter's endearing discomfort. They had their own jitters. Were they looking at a new pandemic like AIDS, or had this all been some terrible misunderstanding or misinterpretation of data? Alter said he'd try to review the two presentations and see where they led. He talked about how GAG and ENV sequences for XMRV and closely related viruses in dramatically higher numbers in ME/CFS patients than in controls, and had also detected antibodies in the majority of the patients, and there was no evidence of contamination. Alter was summarizing beautifully. The GAG and ENV sequences were translated into viral proteins unique to this pathogen, and she was finding sequences of greater diversity, which was an indirect argument against contamination that scientists should have understood. Contaminants usually don't show wide genetic diversity, but are more one note. Evolution generally proceeds at a predictable rate, and thus the finding of sequence variation was another indicator that this virus had been present in humans for some time. The finding of antibodies in the patients with these GAG and ENV sequences was key, since antibodies are only generated in a human body as the immune system responds to a perceived invader. Antibodies could not be generated in a test tube. Mikovits had been able to detect XMRV sequences and proteins in samples collected at different times from the same patient, thus lowering the possibility of a mistaken result. Her team had also cultured virus from blood cells and unmanipulated plasma, and tested again and again for contamination and found no evidence of it. They had tried to make it fail-safe. Alter continued, now discussing the Coffin data. What Alter was describing at this point was the beginning of the shift away from the mousecrap theory of XMRV to the holy mousecrap, we created a retrovirus, but don't worry, it's not dangerous, theory that Coffin would now put forth as the main objection to the work of Mikovits and Rossetti. Coffin was continuing with the mousecrap theory of contamination by claiming he'd found evidence of mouse mitochondrial DNA in his assays, but was shifting the argument by claiming a recombinant mouse-human retrovirus was possibly infecting 22RV1, a prostate cancer cell line. This cell line was widely used, and it was reasonable to suspect this was the reason for the results reported in the positive studies, although Alter mentioned it had not been in the Mikovits lab. Alter continued with Coffin's argument that XMRV had been created in a lab. He further shows that XMRV might be a hybrid, a recombinant of two pre-XMRV viruses, one of them, which is replication competent, the other of which is not, and if you put these two together, it almost perfectly matches XMRV. A pathogenic exogenous virus is one which can infect the organism and spread to other organisms of the same species and cause disease. But eventually, over time, as Darwin's ruthless survival of the fittest works its way through a species, those who survive at the highest rates are the people who have rendered the virus harmless. There are many ways to do this. The immune system can learn how to destroy the virus. Some can vary the receptor that a specific virus uses. As they discovered with the elite controllers in HIV/AIDS, some lacked a receptor, which would allow the HIV retrovirus to gain access to the cells and cause disease. The most common defense, thousands of retroviruses have been rendered non-pathogenic this way, is to silence the virus and eventually cause enough changes that it is no longer a competent virus A virus, which had become endogenized, meant it was present in the host genome and could be passed to offspring, but had lost the ability to harm that organism. Specifically, Coffin was suggesting that the passage of prostate cancer tissue through a certain species of laboratory mice, the nude mice, had generated a new hybrid replication competent, able to reproduce, retrovirus that matched very well with the XMRV sequences reported by Silverman. Alter continued with his summation of Coffin's argument. Thus, Coffin claimed that XMRV evolved when XMRV-negative prostate cancer xenografts were passaged in these nude mice and then became infected over time. That XMRV is a recombinant of two pre-XMRV strains, only one of which is replication competent. That XMRV was created in a lab long after MECFS was recognized as a clinical entity, and that XMRV is a contaminant that does not warrant further study. This was a second kind of contamination. These relatively brief restatements by Alter described the central battlefield where Mikovits and Coffin would fight it out over the next 6 months before their confrontation at the Ottawa meeting in September 2011. In spite of the fury of their arguments, they did agree on important components. Mikovits had no difficulty believing that the XMRV sequences, as found by Silverman in his prostate cancer sample tissues, had been generated by the passage of prostate cancer tissue through nude mice as described by Coffin. Coffin was alleging that there was a Frankenstein-like recombinant retrovirus related to mouse xenotropic virus that had been created in a lab and readily infected human cells, but that scientists shouldn't worry about this freak monster. The unanswered question to Mikovits was that if one recombinant retrovirus had been created through the passage of human tissue through mice tissue, how many others had been created in the last 50 years of human-to-mouse xenotransplantation? Could something very similar have been created by an earlier passage of human tissue through mice in another lab? Why couldn't that question be asked? Why was Coffin arguing that XMRV was a contaminant that didn't need to be studied any further? Wasn't that an abandonment of scientific curiosity? A patronizing parent telling his scientific children there was no monster under the bed? Alter continued with his summation. So where do we go with these two very divergent pieces of data? I do want to give you this cautionary note. The fact that contamination can occur, and nobody doubts that, does not mean that it has occurred in any given laboratory. There is, as yet, no direct evidence for contamination in either the Mikovits lab or the Lowe laboratory. So, what are we going to do? I think, rather than cutting the baby in half, the resolution may come. First of all, we have to resolve this issue. Is it contaminant or is it real? And I think that it will be addressed by two coded panels that are currently in preparation. The answer was that there would be two investigations, one by the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute. This would be known as the Blood Working Group, and a second investigation funded by the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Diseases, headed by Anthony Fauci, which would come to be known as the Lipkin Multicenter Study. Many in the ME/CFS community were skeptical about Fauci, an opinion described by Court Johnson's Phoenix Rising website, when he wrote that Fauci has been no friend to ME/CFS. In fact, he's been considered a major problem for years. He appointed Steven Strauss to head the CFS team in the 1980s and moved for ME/CFS to get kicked out of the Institute 10 years ago, an event which led to years of research declines as the program slowly disintegrated in the backwater that is the little Office for Research on Women's Health. Mikovits hoped Fauci wouldn't have too much influence over the investigation. The selection of patients who'd never been tested for XMRV concerned her. If there was contamination, it would have taken place in the lab as the samples were being processed. To do a replication study, the logical step was to go back to those patients who had previously tested positive. There was a possibility their samples could have been contaminated, but the patients would not have been contaminated by a needle stick, so newly drawn samples processed in a different lab would not show contamination. Once positive by this redundant method, they were clearly infected. To Mikovits, it seemed there was an awful lot of effort going into reinventing the wheel. The very process itself called into question the group's intention. In the months and years to come, she'd wonder if their intention hadn't been to actually invent a square and proclaim a wheel had never existed. Alter finished up his summation. "So I think that's where we stand. These panels are going to come late this spring, early summer. They'll take quite a while to do because they are so complex, but hopefully we'll have some answers this year." The audience members applauded warmly. Alter ended by noting that it was late on a Friday afternoon, but he wanted to give Mikovits the opportunity to make concluding remarks. She did have a few things she wanted to remind the assembled group. "We took the systems biology approach, collected samples from well-defined patients who had the infectious characteristics that Tony Komaroff talked about, that were in the Lowe study, that Dan Peterson had done. These patients had data on them for decades. We took samples over 3 years. So it wasn't that we found the sample in every sample indicated, like the macaque study where it quickly went into the tissue, like the mouse study that came out this week that said that the antibody responses were weak and transient. We don't know everything about this virus, but HIV does not cause AIDS. The CDC definition is HIV and one of 25 co-pathogens, so the Lyme, the EBV, the enteroviruses. We've developed a cytokine signature that is distinct from Nancy's, Climus's, cytokine signature, and from Ben Nadelson, so this is a marker to follow on clinical trial improvement. If one used HIV as a template for the damage this retrovirus caused, it fit like a glove. The CDC's own definition of AIDS was infection with the HIV retrovirus and one of 25 other co-pathogens, including Lyme, Epstein-Barr virus, and a host of others. It made sense then that the antivirals, antibiotics, or similar medications, which went after some of these co-pathogens, would have the effect of lessening the severity of the disease, just as they did with AIDS. They were developing inflammatory cytokine signatures, which would allow them to figure out which medications might be most effective for each individual patient. In the view of Mikovits, the future beckoned with hope for treatment for these patients if the researchers would but open their eyes, remember their training, and see the evidence in front of them. She continued, "Whatever their disease is, they are infected and sick, and I know John Chia has patients that are co-infected with enteroviruses, and they don't treat the same way. So we can get together with the physicians who have co-infected patients, even Lyme doctors who we're working with across the country, and start doing something now. Take it out of CFS. It's not about CFS. It's about a retrovirus we don't understand very well." As Frank Rossetti said in a meeting a month or so ago, if this were HIV, it would be 1983. That's all. Mikovits's urgency made perfect sense, as did her statement that the apparent retrovirus plus co-infections they were seeing put them in a time capsule, trapped like AIDS patients in 1983, when the scientific grasp of the illness was initially like the blind man and the elephant parable, with researchers only seeing a tail but not an ear, or one co-infection but not another. Patients had been suffering for decades, and viable, safe, and effective treatments might be already approved. But even though AIDS had thrust the term fast-tracking into the scientific lexicon to refer to the urgency of getting medications to needed patients, and even though the FDA soon declared ME/CFS to be a serious or life-threatening condition, dealing with affected ME/CFS patients was hugely controversial in retroviral research. Some physicians would argue that antiretrovirals, even though they'd been prescribed for the better part of two decades, and ME/CFS still lacked FDA-approved drugs of its own, presented unacceptable risks, and should not be used until more definitive information was available. This was the position Ian Lipkin had taken. But she had seen how devastating the condition could be, and Mikovits also thought it was perfectly reasonable for people to attempt to use antiretrovirals under an astute doctor's care. The same drugs were given to pregnant women with HIV and their children to ensure the mothers didn't give their kids AIDS. She felt a trial of antiretrovirals, drugs that had received rigorous trials and funding, with proven use around the globe, was perfectly reasonable for patients with a serious and life-threatening condition. Mikovits told the assembled group that even if they didn't think antiretrovirals were medically sound, they could consider interventions like immune modulators with a better safety profile. Mikovits thought the research should be accelerated. Mikovits felt that Coffin seemed intent on burying it. The unpublished research that John Coffin had referenced at the May 2011 State of the Knowledge Conference at the NIH finally came out in Science on June 1, 2011. The title was Recombinant Origins of the Retrovirus XMRV, and while Mikovits may have questioned the research, especially since they were focusing so much on Silverman's VP62 clone of XMRV, his conclusions particularly alarmed her. The Retrovirus XMRV, Xenotropic Murine Leukemia Virus-Related Virus, has been detected in human prostate tumors and in blood samples from patients with CFS, but these findings have not been replicated. We hypothesize that an understanding of when and how XMRV first arose might help explain the discrepant results. We conclude that XMRV was not present in the original CWR22 tumor, but was generated by recombination of two proviruses during tumor passaging in mice. Coffin was suggesting XMRV might have been created by the passage of human prostate cancer tissue through mice. They were able to find XMRV in the prostate cancer cell lines, and it was their belief that XMRV was created by the recombination of two proviruses during tumor passaging in mice. The authors emphasized that the probability of this exact recombination was so low that it would never occur again. Mikovits couldn't help but think that her colleagues had all lost their collective mind. Didn't they see the foretold danger in their words? Did this research actually make them feel safe containment had taken place? For Mikovits, this could be a possible catastrophe. Coffin's work, at face value, showed that a replication-competent retrovirus had been inadvertently created by passing human tissue through mice. A month later, a publication from Adi Gasder's team showed that murine leukemia viruses from many different laboratory lines could become airborne, infecting human cells grown in the same lab. No retrovirus had ever demonstrated the ability to efficiently spread through the air, so this was alarming. The virus didn't generate much of an immune response and disappeared quickly from the blood and moved into tissues. With all of this information, Coffin was still suggesting this was a novel, singular event, something that, while unprecedented in scientific history, deserved absolutely no further investigation. Mikovits believed Coffin was effectively claiming that this event was something akin to an immaculate recombination, an event so unprecedented and rare in history that it would be a waste of future research dollars. But Alter and Lowe's confirmatory study had found something very close to what Silverman had reported as XMRV, not Silverman's sequences. Mikovits's conclusions from the data were the opposite of Coffin's. A potentially airborne, recombinant retrovirus had to be studied. It was unlikely to be immaculate or one time only. More likely was that it had happened before, maybe not XMRV, but closely related viruses. Scientists had been passaging human tissue through mice for more than 70 years. Was this truly the first time retroviruses had recombined? What said that recombination events had to lead to the exact same replication-competent virus? Scientists lived in fear that the next pandemic would occur when a virus might jump from one species to another among animals living on a farm. For decades, they might have been accelerating that process by passing tissue from humans directly through animals. Had they fully understood the ramifications of what they were doing? This was why, during the Ottawa conference of August 2011, Mikovits asked the important question, "How many have we created, John? How many XMRVs are out there?" But it didn't seem anyone was interested in the question.